Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. When Dr. Christine Montross completed her psychiatric residency, she asked her mentor to evaluate two possible career paths. But her mentor asked about a third. What about prison work? The most interesting doctors I know work in prisons. Well, after initially rejecting that idea, she worked as an inpatient psychiatrist, but she found herself in interacting with the criminal justice system on a regular basis. The associate professor of psychiatry at Brown University Medical School began asking questions about our system and our criminalization of mental illness. In her book, Waiting for an Echo, The Madness of American Incarceration, she shares stories of some of the people serving in the correctional system because of their mental illness, which in turn is exacerbated by the system itself. She also examines the system for the way it treats and confines the people within it, which is set against an immutable rule that those there have done wrong and wrongs must be punished, regardless if it was mental illness at its heart. Finally, it looks to places that have a different system with better results for those within it and the population in general. 95% of Americans imprisoned will eventually be released back into their communities. Today, 68% of those will spend more time in some form of recidivism in the system. Waiting for an Echo is a cry for a system that helps those both within and those outside the American correctional system. Dr. Christine Montross is my guest today. Dr. Montross, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
In your book, Waiting for an Echo, you write about our American incarceration system and also how people with mental illness permeate this system. And you write that our system routinely makes people with mental illness worse, and just as often, it routinely makes mentally stable people psychiatrically unwell. You write about this through your own practice and work as a psychiatric examiner, in addition to being a professor, in your examinations of detention centers, jails, and prisons in the course of this book. How did you reach that conclusion?
I work as an inpatient psychiatrist in a psychiatric hospital. I work on the intensive treatment units, which are the psychiatric version of the ICU. So the patients that I treat are severely mentally ill. They're hearing voices or seeing visions, or they're actively trying to hurt themselves or other people, or they're paranoid. And over in the course of my practice, I would often hear my patients talk about coming in contact with police or serving time in our nation's jails and prisons. And when I talked to them about their experiences, it became clear to me that the reasons that they were becoming involved with the legal system often had more to do with their psychiatric symptoms than any kind of criminal intent. So they'd be shouting in the Starbucks or charging through TSA because they had a delusional belief that they needed to get on a flight to save someone. And in these moments, the police were called. And in the moment of the police encounter, then there was a decision to be made about whether the person should be brought to a hospital, a therapeutic environment, or a prison, a punitive environment. And that decision made in the moment of the police encounter really had the power to shape the next years of the lives of the patients I was talking to.
Yeah, you began by asking us to imagine two different encounters with police, the same symptoms expressed by the person, the police responding to a same transgression, but in one, a person is sent into the treatment system. The second, they go to jail. How do those outcomes actually differ in your experience?
Yeah, this was an example in the book that I've actually seen over and over again. But the story I describe is two real people who I evaluated. One I saw performing competency to stand trial evaluations in our jail. This was a man who had refused to leave a convenience store after he was asked to do so. That's criminal trespass. So the police were called. He hid behind a dumpster and refused to come out. He was extremely paranoid. The police took him to jail, where he refused to take any kind of psychiatric medication and remained really paranoid. He was asked to leave his cell at one point and refused to do so. So the correctional officers performed what they call a cell extraction, where they forcibly removed him from the prison cell. And in his paranoia, he actually began striking the correctional officers and was charged with assaulting one of the officers. Assault of a correctional officer is a felony charge in the state where this man was. That comes with a maximum penalty of up to 15 years in prison. And I contrast that example with a patient I treated in my hospital who was also paranoid. He was shouting in his neighborhood about the militia, feeling he was a subject in a government experiment. The police were called, and they brought this man to my hospital. He remained paranoid and also refused to take psychiatric medication. And in the hospital, he misinterpreted the closure of some blinds as a signal that he was about to be executed. He ran out of the kitchen in my unit and said, "Tonight's the night they're going to kill us all," and started assaulting the workers on my hospital unit. He actually really harmed people. He gave two young women a concussion, and one of the men who was working there required knee surgery from the assault. But no one pressed charges because everyone understood that he was acting out of his mental illness. He was released 3 weeks later from the hospital to his home after we were really able to get his symptoms under control and connect him with outpatient treatment. So that gentleman was facing spent 3 weeks in the hospital and then returned home. And another man who was very much like him faced spending the next decade and a half of his life in prison.
Yeah. That gives us a sense of it. And of course, you explain sort of the history, the back history, if you will, and the fact that our criminal justice system has become a part of a larger trend of transinstitutionalization, where people went into a large mental health system, which did have flaws, there's no doubt about it. But now the criminal justice system oftentimes serves as that institutional system for people suffering with mental illness.
That's right. In the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, people with good reason had an inclination to move people out of our psychiatric state hospitals into the community. Part of this was because, as you say, the state hospitals were sometimes draconian places. There was not always good care that was given in these institutions. Also, we started to have psychiatric medications that actually worked. Thorazine was developed, which treated hallucinations. It was the first medicine to do so. So there was great promise that people could move from these institutionalized settings back into the community. The problem was that the funds required to provide community support to these severely mentally ill people never materialized. So you had people who had required hospital level of care who now did not have a place to live, didn't have meals provided to them, didn't have access to their medications, and suddenly they were sleeping in doorways and on park benches. They were begging for money or stealing subsistence items. And suddenly this group of mentally ill people moved from the auspices of healthcare into the realm of criminal justice. And we cite that moment as the criminalization of mental illness. And suddenly they were under the auspices of the legal system. And as you say, wasn't just deinstitutionalization, it was transinstitutionalization. People were shifted from therapeutic institutions into punitive ones and suddenly housed within our jails and prisons.
Now, you visited a number of detention centers, jails, and prisons. Do you see any of those facilities that do a better job than most at helping people who are exhibiting mental illness, in helping them cope with that and, you know, hopefully be able to move on and get out of the criminal justice system?
Absolutely. So there are places that are doing this here in the U.S. There are places that are doing this abroad. And I was able, in researching Waiting for an Echo, to go both to places in America and to places in Sweden and Norway and look at how different approaches are yielding really different results. One profound example in America is the Cook County Jail in Chicago, which is in fact our nation's largest psychiatric institution, even though it's not a psychiatric institution, it's a jail, but it holds more mentally ill people than any other facility in our country. And the sheriff there, Sheriff Tom Dart, has been really intentional about infusing the jail with mental health treatment. He's hired mental health clinicians to be heads of important positions at the jail, and he's really established therapeutic programs with the pure intention of keeping people out of prison once they leave. And I was able to witness these and sit in on some of the therapeutic groups, and they were quite astounding. The paradox, of course, is that that's not the place where people should be receiving treatment, but given that they're there and they're there in such great numbers, Sheriff Dart deserves credit for providing that treatment to people since they're there.
You know, it's interesting. I read that chapter, and I guess that gives you a sense of perhaps the low bar Because when I was reading that chapter, I was thinking, you know, here's a jurisdiction that recognizes the scope of the problem. And I think you write that Cook County Jail, out of the 9,000 detainees, because many of them are there for a short amount of time. They're going either into the prison system later or after trial if they're found guilty or for minor offenses. But 2,000 of the 9,000 detainees there have some form of mental illness. And my reading of your account gave me a sense that even though they're very much trying to deal with this situation, they're pretty much ill-equipped.
Yeah, they're definitely inundated. And again, the environment is not the appropriate environment. And Sheriff Dart will say part of the problem is that the community has come to expect the prison to provide this service. And he'll say, what I should do is just let it all collapse and force the legislature to build mental health services elsewhere. But the cost of that would be people's lives. So they're trying to scramble, given that they have so many mentally ill detainees, to provide the services that they can when people are in their facility. But you're absolutely right that it's not an ideal situation by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, your book looks at both how people end up in prison, especially those with mental illness. The second part of the book looks at how we do correctionalize the people that do come there. And then the last section looks at maybe better practices. And one of the things that becomes very apparent that, you know, in correctional facilities, there's sort of this ironclad belief that those that are there have done something wrong and they deserve punishment.
Yeah, right. And you hear people say things like, if you can't stand the time, don't do the crime. And you hear people espouse the belief that once you've ended up in prison, you must have done something bad, so you deserve whatever happens to you once they're there. So it becomes a justification for all kinds of dehumanizing and degrading behavior. There are several things that are wrong with this. One is, of course, that people wind up in prison for all kinds of different reasons. Some people wind up there because they've genuinely done something bad. But some people wind up there because they're mentally ill. Others are there by virtue of poverty or racial injustice. In one of the sections of the book, a group of white friends of mine discusses all the ways in which they've broken the law without consequence. And we really look at the fact that there are people serving time in jail and prison for the very offenses that white friends of mine have committed without any kinds of repercussion. So we have to be honest about acknowledging the fact that not everyone who's, it's not as simple as saying everyone who's in prison is bad and everyone who's not in prison is good. It's also really short-sighted to think that we should justify dehumanizing, degrading practices, because 95% of the people who are incarcerated in America come back to our communities. So we ought to want their time in prison to make them stronger and better able to contribute to our society, better able to have family relationships and hold jobs and pay taxes. But in fact, what we do is render them less able to do all of these things, which doesn't serve our communities well, and it certainly doesn't serve the people well.
My guest today is Dr. Christine Montross. She's an associate professor of psychiatry and human behavior at the medical school at Brown University. She's also a practicing inpatient psychiatrist. She sees people in her practice. She also does psychiatric examinations for people intersecting with the criminal justice system. And her examination of detention centers, jails, and prisons, and how our correctional system deals with mental illness is titled Waiting for an Echo, The Madness of American Incarceration. It's now out in softcover. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You do write that this does affect everyone. As you mentioned, 95% of people who are in prison eventually are released. And of course, our recidivism rate, which is, you know, goes back to the practices that occur in these correctional institutions, is not great. And, you know, this, how people are treated in the correctional system affects everyone. It affects the institutionalized, it affects the corrections officers and the people that are governing that space. It affects the population. It affects medical professionals and people who are trying to come in and help prisoners. This system is really not working well.
That's right. And one of the points of hope that I found in researching this subject that sometimes was rather bleak was that at a time when there's almost zero bipartisan consensus in America, Republicans and Democrats alike agree on the need for prison reform. The system as we know it is ineffective, it's inefficient, it doesn't yield the results we want, it costs a lot of money, and it's also inhumane. So I actually find that a point of great solace that a few years ago, Cory Booker and Newt Gingrich shared a stage together to talk about the need for prison reform. So I think there's a great deal of hope and promise that we can work together to try to make a better system than the one we have today.
I want to talk a little bit about prison reform. We've had some prison reform in Oklahoma and Texas and other surrounding states. I think what politicians see for the most part is a way to save money. They see the drain of the correctional system, and yet you have to replace you have to replace the services that, for how well or bad the correctional system is doing, you have to replace that in the community, especially if you are not incarcerating these folks. They're going to need services. And what I don't see is any effort to expanding the services for people who are suffering from episodes or mental illness, long-term mental illness, and making sure that there's a place for them where they can feel safe and they don't constantly re-interact with the criminal justice system. You know, do you see any efforts within prison correctional reform?
I do. I think that there are increasingly programs that are trying to pay attention to, you know, the term that's often used is reentry, to support and stabilize people once they leave these environments. But also, I think part of what's exciting about the possibility of prison reform is to look to places that are doing this and doing it well. So one of the chapters in Waiting for an Echo that was the most kind of fun and exciting to write was visiting Scandinavia to see how things are done differently in different countries with better results. So one of the places that I visited was Halden Prison in Norway, and talking to them about these services that they provide and how they stabilize people. Norway had a recidivism rate in the 1990s that was very similar to ours. Ours is at 68%. Theirs was between 60 and 70%. And they had a lot of the problems in prisons that we have today. They had riots and violence. They had murders of correctional officers and detainees. They had escapes. And their prison system just was not working. So they decided to take a completely different approach. And the way that they describe it is to say they stopped meeting hard with hard, and they started meeting hard with soft. What they meant by that was that they began to use the period of corrections as a time uniquely focused on preventing the person from returning to prison once they left. So they did a needs assessment at the beginning to try to say, what do you need during this period of time that will prevent you from committing crimes in the future? Do you need anger management treatment or job training? Do you need education or substance abuse treatment or mental health treatment? And then using the period of corrections, in contrast to the American idea of just doing time, to really focus on those deficits to try to shore the person up so when they leave, they don't return. And their recidivism rate is now at 20%. So it's really, really worked. And they've integrated services from the community. So when you talk about the economics of a community that supports the prison, they bring in the same teachers and dentists and therapists and doctors that are working in these communities into the prison to treat the people while they are there, to teach the people while they are there. Then when people leave the prison, they already have established relationships with a support network when they leave with community providers. And it also allows people in the community to have a clearer sense of the fact that these people in the prison are human beings. They have interactions with them that make them understand the humanity of the detainees.
There's a couple of moments in the book where you hear COs talking, correctional officers, and you know, you can almost hear the dehumanizational speech. And then every once in a while, you'll hear them catch. And I think it was a female correctional officer who said, you know, a youthful offender, and he's talking about how this kid had been such a jerk, and he wasn't planning for his release, and it's like 14 degrees out, he doesn't have anywhere to go, and all of a sudden, he realizes this on nearly the last day of his confinement. He goes, I don't even have a coat. And as she's recounting that, you know, she talks about what a jerk this kid had been. And then she all of a sudden catches and says, "Oh, this was a person." And I think that's a big problem, I think, in our correctional facilities. I think for so much is that because of the way we incarcerate people, and you write about this in the second part of the book, the fact that we use segregation in all sorts of ways, and I'm talking about solitary confinement, the design and procedures of the prison itself is designed as punishment.
That's right. And many of us have had professional relationships at work that are adversarial, and we know how stressful that can be, how upsetting that can be. And so for correctional officers in America, the nature of the job is an adversarial job. And just earlier today on a call-in show, I had a former correctional officer call in who said, we had to dehumanize the people who are in detention because you can't survive any other way. You know, you're in these long hours and these awful conditions. You live in this world just like they live in this world, and you get to go home, but you take the stress home with you. So one of the coping mechanisms is this us versus them mentality, because the environment is such a difficult environment to exist within. You know, the suicide rate of correctional officers is higher even than police or the military. Job satisfaction is very low. So we definitely disserve detainees when we hold them in these degrading situations, but we also disserve the people that we ask to perform these incredibly difficult jobs.
In that second part of the book, you look at the design of an architect that boasts that his prison is designed to inflict discomfort to the people that are held there. And also what I really found really sad was the treatment of youthful offenders in one particular place that you went to. And, you know, you have youthful offenders that could see up to a year in solitary for transgressions. And I think of this on a youthful brain. And there's a often quoted scene from this book in which you saw kids standing on top of the toilet, straining like straining up to the top of their enclosure. And you found out what was going on. What were these kids doing?
Yeah. So this was a juvenile detention facility in Connecticut that housed 14 to 20-year-old boys. You're exactly right that when I asked the worst punishment that these kids could receive, I was told they could be sent to administrative segregation or solitary confinement for up to a year. And as a neuroscientist, thinking about the developing teenage brain and the damage that it would do to isolate a child for that period of time, we know the adolescent brain continues to develop until the age of 25 and needs stimulation and interaction to develop appropriately. So the damage that that alone would incur was really haunting to me. And later, when I was walking through the facility and saw, exactly as you describe, a boy in his cell standing on his toilet, craning his neck to the ceiling and talking at the corner of the room, as someone who deals with severely mentally ill people, I assumed that he was mentally ill, that he was speaking to his voices or visions. But then I continued down the hallway and saw another boy in the next cell doing the exact same thing. And as many mentally ill people as I've treated, I've never seen psychotic symptoms manifest themselves in identical ways. So I said to the correctional officer, "What are they doing?" And he said, "It's a real problem. They've determined that if they get up on their toilets, they can talk into the vents and they can have whole conversations that way." And that really, really registered with me that here were boys in an extraordinary set of circumstances that were trying to have these basic, fundamental, necessary human connections. And that's really where the title of the book came from. It reminded me of this Richard Wright quote where Wright wrote, "I would hurl words into the darkness and wait for an echo. And if an echo sounded, no matter how faintly, I would send other words to tell, to march, to fight, to create a sense of the hunger for life that gnaws in us all." And that image of boys hurling words into the darkness and waiting for an echo became for me one of the most profound moments of my research in writing this book.
My guest today is Dr. Christine Montross. Her new book is titled Waiting for an Echo, The Madness of American Incarceration. It's now out in softcover. And as I mentioned, the last section, you describe some of the things you saw in Scandinavia and in Norway, for example. I want to ask about some better practices we can adopt, maybe some first steps we can begin in the United States to maybe start changing our practices. I know some cities are having mental health officers go with police officers on calls for that initial encounter with the criminal justice system. You know, prison reform is going on. What do you, would you say is the best first step the American system can take?
I think that the first thing that you describe in terms of having a mental health care response to psychiatric emergencies is a critical step. That's keeping mentally ill people out of the system in the first place, which is really an enormous piece of the puzzle. And I think the energy going toward that is great. Washington, D.C. has described that they're going to start sending clinicians to mental health emergencies. Chicago has made that decision too. Oregon has a long-standing tradition of that sort of response, so I think that's exciting and that's necessary. I think the one thing that we could do really differently if we take Norway as a model is that Norway redefined the role of the correctional officer. They are still responsible for security, but they receive additional training to really also have a role that's much more like a social worker or a nurse. That they get to know the men and women to whom they are assigned, and they develop a relationship with these people where part of it is keeping them safe and the environment safe, but a real part of it is keeping the people forward-looking and focused on how they need to use their time in order to plan for their future after prison. It takes the fire out of that adversarial relationship, and it creates a more constructive environment that's more fulfilling for correctional officers. It creates safer prisons because you don't have the violence and aggression between the correctional officers and the detainees. And it gives detainees a sense of hope and uses their time constructively so they're less apt to return to prison. I think that's an exciting and wonderful model, and nothing's stopping us from making those kinds of shifts in the laboratory of our state.
You know, as you well know, the prison system is really abandoned for the most part. Its role of rehabilitation is what we used to refer to that. This idea of forward-looking, of figuring out ways to make your way in life after prison. Are there any places that are beginning to do that in the United States?
I think there are. Yeah, there absolutely are. There's some isolated programs around the country that are doing this sort of thing. And I think there are programs around the world that are doing this sort of thing. So I think we don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's an organization in California that's taking stakeholders, and by that I mean wardens, correctional officers, policymakers, over to Germany and Scandinavia to see how this works and works differently so that they can come back and implement some of these practices in the U.S. So there are groups in Los Angeles County, in North Dakota, in Rhode Island, in my home state, who are actively trying to make some of these changes. So I do have a lot of hope that those kinds of changes can come about. And because so many jails and prisons are run by states and counties, there are small changes that can be made that can have a huge, huge impact.
Dr. Montross, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Christine Montross is an associate professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University Medical School and is a practicing inpatient psychiatrist. Her examination of the intersection between mental illness and the American criminal justice system is titled Waiting for an Echo, The Madness of American Incarceration. It's now out in softcover from Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.